Hello. My name online is Ahuka, which is a kind of a odd one, perhaps, but let me explain a little bit about where that comes from. And then I want to get into what brings me here to Hacker Public Radio. Now, as for the name Ahuka, that's just it's a nickname. It's spelled A-H-U-K-A. And what it comes from is a Japanese record album where they did they picked up the Jefferson Airplane record. The album name was Surrealistic Pillow, and there's a song on there that you've probably heard called White Rabbit. And they said they decided they were going to put the lyrics, print them on the cover of the LP. But they got it slightly off. So there's a line in the song that says, "Tell them a hookah-smoking caterpillar has given you the call." And on this Japanese LP, it somehow got turned to, "Tell them a hookah," with a capital A, proper name, "the swooping caterpillar has given you the call." And I happen to be a big Jefferson Airplane fan, and at the time there was this mailing list that Jefferson Airplane fans hung out on, and we all thought this was absolutely hilarious. And so that became kind of a running joke, and I kind of adopted it as an online nom de plume, so to speak, and been using it for a number of years ever since. So what I want to do here, I said on Google Plus, where I spend a lot of time these days, and I'm connected with Ken Fallon and Henry Patrick Riley and all of that. And which, for those of you who don't know, there was a time when Google was absolutely forbidding anyone to use a business name on Google Plus. And Ken wanted to get this going, and he had set up Hacker Public Radio, and then they started cracking down. So he created a profile called Henry Patrick Riley, and that was kind of a way to get around that, as obviously the same HPR initials. And so I posted there the other day and sent this to Ken saying, all right, Ken, you've been saying you want more people to contribute, and by golly, I ought to be able to do some of that. So this is what I think should be the beginning of a number of these recordings that I'm going to do and send to Hacker Public Radio. And I find I'm already brimming with ideas for various things. But I've noticed that most people, at least the first time they do it, try and do a little bit of an introduction, what got them to where they are now, and particularly if you're a Linux user, which I am, you know, how did you get into it? So I think this is going to be my introductory recording podcast here. I'm probably a little older than some of the people who you hear on Hacker Public Radio, because my earliest experiences with computers really go back to the late 60s. Yep, I'm that old. And you know, in those days, when you talked about computers, you were mostly talking, at least the ones I interacted with mainframes. And it was a very different sort of thing. Mainframes existed in a separate temple where there was a priesthood that maintained and operated them. And, you know, the rest of us who wanted to somehow make use of it, you know, we would have to do things like prepare boxes of punched cards. And, oh boy, were those days fun. So if you had data that you wanted to enter, a program you wanted to run, you know, you would punch it all onto these IBM punched cards. And these punched cards had 80 characters across, 80 columns, which is why the earliest monitors that came with computers, the monochrome monitors, were also 80 characters across. Just happened to be that, you know, they were matching the initial punched card capacity. Now, in those days, you know, with punched cards, there were certain things that could cause you a great deal of trouble. One of them was if the cards get out of order. If you can just imagine having a whole box full, you know, hundreds of these cards, and, you know, God forbid you bumped into someone in the hallway and dropped this box of cards, you'd have to be able to get them back in order, which was a bit of a problem. One of the tricks we had back then was to draw a diagonal line across the top with something like a magic marker. And that made it very easy to, you know, if there weren't too many cards, too many, you know, it made it a lot easier to get them back into order because you had some sort of visual thing. And then if a card was out of order, it tended to stand out a little bit more. So those were my my earliest experiences with computers. And later on, when I was in college, you know, I went to work first. I didn't go to college till I was in my late 20s. And the college I went to, we had computer accounts that linked to a mainframe, but using a teletype terminal. Well, you know, if you take a look at the terminal that you have in a Linux machine now, which it just opens up as a window. Why do they call it a terminal? Well, I mean, it used to actually be a terminal. So when you see the TTY for teletype, what they were talking about was something that had a keyboard and a roll of paper, and you could type in stuff, and it would go to the computer, which was located somewhere else, and whatever the computer spit back at you would come back and be printed on those rolls of paper. So I remember being in college and wrote my first program using Dartmouth Basic. So, you know, that even preceded so-called Visual Basic, which is something Microsoft came up with years later. But, you know, this was the original Basic, and, you know, every line had a number, you know. So line 10, line 20, line 30, and so on. And so it ran things in that order. You know, that wasn't a bad way to learn something about computers. I got some very basic good grounding there in college, writing programs in BASIC that really helped me to understand how computers work. Now, none of those would be what you would call personal computers. So when did I first get a personal computer? Actually, the first one I ever got was called a Sinclair Z80, although my memory is it had a different brand. Maybe it was the Timex version of this. But the Sinclair Z80, which I think probably paid about $100 for back in 1980, came with 1 kilobyte of RAM. That's right, 1 kilobyte. So we're not talking megabytes or gigabytes or any of the things you're used to now. 1 kilobyte of RAM. And that was the standard. But I remember looking at this and thinking, okay, 1 kilobyte is enough, but, you know, over the years, we're probably going to need more. So they offered a 16-kilobyte expansion pack, and being a really forward-thinking kind of person, I said, ah, that is for me. I must get the 16-kilobyte. So I ordered that, and, you know, that came, you know, the basic unit was just a keyboard with some processing stuff built into it, and you bolted this RAM expansion pack onto the back. For a monitor, you would use a television. So I had this old black and white TV. They were more common back then, and that was really all you needed because it was a monochrome. Anyway, you know, with 1 kilobyte of RAM, you were not going to be doing color processing, trust me on that one. Then if you created a program or something like that, you used a cassette tape drive. And so you would record stuff onto the cassette tape drive and bring that back. So you had to supply your own tape drive, your own monitor. Well, you know, any cassette player would work. And say any old television would work. So I had that. And then in 81, I went into graduate school. And at that point, you know, I'm back to mainframes, teletype terminals, and, you know, dropping off jobs to be run. And you had to pay for your time. That was another interesting little thing. So if you were in college, university, what have you, they might give you an account, and the account would give you an allocation of a certain number of dollars. And that's what you had available. God forbid you ran out. So one of the things that we had to do was we had to economize as much as possible. So one of the tricks that us old-timers remember was, you know, taking our box of punch cards down to the computing center at around 3 a.m. because at 3 a.m. the computing time was so cheap, you could really stretch your allocation a lot further. So you would take it down and you'd give them your punch cards or whatever and tell them to run it. And then you would come back the next day, and with any luck, you'd pick up a printout that had all of the results you needed. Well, what happened if you had made a mistake, if you needed to change something? Well, you had to change the punch cards and come back the next day and drop them off. You know, again, come down at 3 a.m. to make it as cheap as possible, and then, you know, pick it up. So it was several days later that before you got anything. But, you know, that was what we had, and, you know, it's not bad, because I actually remember in the early 1970s doing by hand linear regressions, doing the matrix mathematics. And so what that basically meant was you'd have columns of numbers, and you'd take this column, and you'd square every number that was in the column, and then you'd take column A minus column B, you'd do a subtraction, then you'd square that result, and stuff like that. And it was just pages and pages and pages of calculations. Well, at the time where I got to working on my dissertation, I talked to a faculty member about that, and he said, well, I'll be the advisor for your doctoral dissertation on one condition: you must purchase a personal computer. And his reasoning was that if you got a word processor, you could actually get it done. And I think the way he put it was, I'll be dead before you finish unless you buy a personal computer. So, okay. So I think I spent $2,000 to purchase an XT, a PC XT, as it was called. And this was an, you know, Intel processor, an 8088, two floppy drives. No hard drive. It was running DOS. The word processing program was Word Perfect. And so what you had to do was you would have to boot from the floppy. Because you had two floppy drives, you would generally have your software in one and your data disk in the other, in case you wanted to save any of your files. And so this used the 5 1/4 inch floppy drives, and they held, oh good lord, I think it was like 360K, which seems like an incredible amount. And so you'd first you'd boot DOS, and then you'd start up the WordPerfect program, and then, you know, you'd start typing and save your stuff. Well, you know, that got me going, but I right away started to get curious about what's going on with this computer and started digging into it. And, you know, tried various things. There were even, in those monochrome days, there was even online stuff. I know that's hard to imagine. You know, there were places you could go online and connect to people. Not so much the internet at that point, because we're talking like the mid-80s, but there were private net, things like CompuServe, the Sierra Network, Prodigy, things like that. So I was trying those things out. And also trying to figure out what's going on with my computer. And at a certain point, I started to get interested in games, and you immediately ran into a problem, because those old computers, they came with essentially 640K of RAM. And that's not entirely true. Actually, what they came with was a megabyte of RAM, but it wasn't all available to you. So the upper part, the you know, we say a megabyte, we mean, you know, 1,024 kilobytes. So it's the binary version, not the metric version. And what we would do is the upper 384K was devoted to handling the video processing and stuff like that. So 640K was what was left after all of that. Well, it was really hard to get everything in there. If you wanted to get the game itself, the drivers, you know, did it run off of a CD drive? You had to load a CD driver if that was the case. And so people came up with all of these tricks to somehow steal a little bit of memory from that upper 384, and, you know, sometimes it was expanded memory, sometimes it was extended, you know, and they were two different ways of basically stealing a few extra K out of that upper 384. And to do that, you'd have to go in, you'd have to tweak your AutoExecBAT and your config sys to do that. And at one point, I got very good at, I had it actually set up with a boot menu in DOS that, you know, you would boot into something that would say, well, you know, choose which configuration you want to be in. And so for a particular game, it's like, all right, I can read this off of a floppy drive, so I don't need the CD driver. I'll drop that. That'll give me a few more K, and then I can take something from the upper and so on. The old days. Somewhere in there is where I actually got my first hard drive, which I think was a whopping 20 megabytes. Oh, I thought we'd never be able to fill a 20 megabyte drive. Ah, those were the days. Well, then I got into, you know, DOS had its limitations. It's a single tasking operating system, fairly primitive. The initial attempt to get something a little bit better was something called Windows. You may have heard of it. I understand it's become rather popular in some circles. So the initial one that I tried was Windows 3.1, which is widely regarded as the first more or less useful version of Windows. And that was really just I think we would call it a shell. You know, it wasn't the kernel of the operating system. It was just this thing that sat on top and allowed you to do some fairly simple graphic manipulations. And I liked that. I thought, okay, that's better than DOS. And then Windows 95 was a real big change. And, you know, that was the one that I think really put Windows on the map to some degree. And I got that, and then, you know, Windows NT, I got into NT 4.0, then Windows 2000, then Windows XP. Well, at a certain point, I started to think, you know, I'm not really happy with Windows. Well, what are we going to do about that? At this point, I was an assistant professor at a college, and I got interested in all of the online stuff. I mean, the internet had come along. And, you know, these days it seems like everyone has just grown up with the internet all around them. I have to tell you, it wasn't always the case. And I can remember back, and this probably would have been sometime in the 90s, maybe the mid-90s, having the college librarian do a demonstration of this internet thing, and it involved running a cable all the way into the auditorium so that we could set up something to show the faculty. It was a very long Ethernet cable that would allow them to get some kind of an online connection. And one of the things that I remember then is that there were so many internet technologies that have gone by the wayside. Like Gopher servers were really big in those days. I think the web has really wiped out the whole network of Gopher servers. But we got into that, and because I was somewhat more tech-savvy than some of the faculty, I was approached to be the faculty development officer with the task specifically of getting my fellow faculty members to use more of this computer technology. So I sort of dove in and started figuring out how I could use websites for my college classes, and that led to, at a certain point, me being put in charge of the college website. And I started getting involved with that, and that's really what got me into my first real connection with Linux, because our server that all of this rested on was a Red Hat server. So I was given a login on this server. It's all command line. We didn't have any of the graphical interfaces, which is probably a good thing, because I've never felt awkward about having to use the command line. I mean, command line's not a problem. As I say, I started with DOS, which is command line anyway, and editing auto exec bat and config sys files and all of that. So, getting into a command line environment with Linux, and it wasn't all that frightening. And I use whichever is most convenient for me now, whether it's the GUI or the command line. I'm not wedded to either. It's whatever is most convenient. So we had this Red Hat server, all command line. It wasn't anything that attracted me as a desktop operating system, because by this point I really had been using Windows for a long time, and I thought, I like the graphical interface. I think it makes sense. I kind of took a look around and discovered that there was this project just getting off the ground called KDE. And it looked really interesting. It wasn't ready for prime time by any sense of the imagination, but it was something I was going to keep an eye on. This could turn into something very useful someday. And then at some point I tried Mandrake. And it had been a few years later, because by this point, KDE had matured, obviously. And so I installed Mandrake on a computer. And I think I did that two or three times. The first time it was like, this is all different. I don't know where anything is. So it didn't last. I tried a few times dual booting and would end up wiping out the Linux one because I just never quite used it. And at some point I did another Mandrake install, and all of a sudden stuff started to click. I was like, oh, wait a minute, I can do this. I just figured out how to get all my email using Evolution. I just figured out how I can, do whatever it is I need to do. And so I was going with Mandrake for a while. And then at a certain point, they started to have their problems, sadly. And I think they probably still do to some degree. And there was this new thing, Ubuntu, that came along. Because I had come from Mandrake and the KDE desktop environment, yes, that is redundant, I know that, but anyway, I went with the KDE version, which is Kubuntu, which I'm still using. That's been my desktop operating system of choice for, I would say, about 5 years now. I still use Windows at work. Windows XP is our standard desktop where I work now. And my wife still uses it, and I'm her tech support, and that's okay. And frankly, I've got a Windows 7 machine here that I keep for gaming and things like that. But most of the time, I'm sticking with Linux. And one of the reasons for that is that I'm a real believer in freedom and using free software and supporting free software. And that's one of the things that when I record more of these, I'm going to be talking about a lot more. But that has really guided me sticking with Linux and trying to support all of that. Now, lately I've been thinking I need to start investigating some other distros and get into that. So, I'm not sure. I think pretty soon now I'm going to do an OpenSUSE and check that out. So we'll see if the combination of KDE with a RPM package management is okay. And so, who knows where that's going to go. I think there's a lot of interesting possibilities out there. And, I want to try a pure Debian at some point. I want to investigate some of the others. I know a lot of the people that are involved with, like the Linux Link Tech Show, for instance. There's a number of them that are big on Arch, so I'm kind of curious about that. And I got a good friend who runs Gen 2 and has been saying, oh, you really ought to do Gen 2. So those probably take a little more work, but it should be an interesting adventure. So anyway, that's the story of what got me to this point. One of the things that I'm a big believer in is, as I say, supporting free software, supporting the community in various ways. And so I actually found myself as president of my local Linux users group. And not because I know more about Linux than anyone else. We've got some really smart people in that group, and I learn from them every time. I just kept going to the Linux users group, and I'd learn a little bit more each time. And then at a certain point, it's like, well, we need someone to keep this thing going. I am now, in terms of my day job, I'm a project manager. So it was actually pretty easy for me to pick up the reins as president of the Linux users group. What I mostly do is just make sure that we have a room to meet in and a speaker to speak each month. And so that's a nice little organizational task that I'm easily up to. And then as a result of that, I came to the attention of a lady named Beth Lynn Eicher. Some of you may know her as the leading organizer of Ohio Linux Fest, who roped me into that one. And so now I do publicity work for Ohio Linux Fest, and that's probably something I'm going to talk about as well as we do some more of these recordings. And to me, those are examples of just, finding an opportunity to give something back and help support the community. I'm not a programmer, never claimed to be a programmer. I'm not going to be developing kernel hacks for anybody. If you are a kernel hacker, God bless you. It's great work that you're doing. But I know that that's not me. And that's fine. It doesn't need to be, because I can make these contributions in other ways. And so those are just some things that I wanted to kind of throw out there. And if you want to check out my website, let me spell it out, because it's a word you probably aren't used to. www.zwilnik.com. Zwilnik. And that name, by the way, comes from a science fiction series of novels. And, when you want a relatively short name that hasn't been taken, you have to look for something unusual, don't you? So that's my domain. And so I post things there. You're welcome to go by it anytime, take a look. And so I think I'm going to sign off for now. This is Ahuka, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. Bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever consider recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.